Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I am professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Today, my guest is Jamie Kelly. We will be talking about his new book, Framing Democracy, A Behavioral Approach to Democratic Theory, which has just been published by Princeton University Press. Jamie Kelly is an assistant professor of philosophy at Vassar College. An old argument that goes back to Plato has it that democracy is nearly the worst form of government because citizens are decidedly unwise. Many styles of democratic theory have tried to meet Plato's argument by denying that democracy has anything to do with wisdom. Democracy, such views claim, is simply a matter of representing citizens' preferences in politics, or instead a matter of giving everyone equal input into the political decision-making process. But even these minimal conceptions of democracy typically want to distinguish between raw and enlightened preferences. They thereby smuggle in considerations regarding the wisdom or rationality of democratic citizens. More recent democratic theories have embraced the epistemic aspect of democratic politics and have tried to show, against Plato, that citizens are not too unwise for self-government. Some of these democratic theories hold that democracy, in fact, requires very little wisdom, and that citizens generally measure up to these requirements. Other views have it that democracy's epistemic demands are indeed significant, but they hold nevertheless that collective judgments of democratic citizens make the grade. In Framing Democracy, Jamie Kelly introduces empirical results concerning human epistemic abilities to bear on the current field of democratic theory. He argues that our susceptibility to framing effects greatly complicates the story democratic theorists must tell about collective self-government and individual rationality. Kelly thereby provides a much-needed empirical check on the claims democratic theorists make, either implicitly or explicitly, about the epistemic powers of citizens. Yet Kelly's book is not simply an update of Plato. Kelly offers institutional and policy proposals for dealing with our epistemic vulnerabilities. Let's turn now to the interview. Hello, Jamie Kelly.
Hello.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today on New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, great. Well, folks, it's presidential election time in the United States, as many of you will know. So today on New Books in Philosophy, I'll be talking to Professor Jamie Kelly about his new book, Framing Democracy, A Behavioral Approach to Democratic Theory, which has just been published by Princeton University Press. Now, Jamie's book is an attempt to bring certain empirical results concerning human reasoning and decision-making to bear on democratic theory. The book is clearly written and very rigorously argued, I found. I highly recommend it to anyone, academic or otherwise, who is interested in the real world of democracy and especially the very often tense relationship between collective self-government and individual rationality. So there's a lot to talk about. But before we get into the details of Jamie's analysis, Jamie, why don't you tell us a little bit about your book and how you got into philosophy and yourself?
Thanks. I'm Canadian originally, so I did my undergraduate degree and my master's degree in Canada at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario. I started university fully intending to be a journalist, and so enrolled in a bunch of English classes and so on. And for reasons that I don't entirely remember or understand, I also signed up for a full year introduction to philosophy, something like contemporary moral, social, and religious issues. And I was just blown away by the course. And so my professor was Marvin Glass, and we did sort of a quick study of a bunch of different political, some epistemological and sort of traditional philosophical questions, and I was hooked. So, you know, took a short break from school. When I came back, declared as a joint English and philosophy major, and proceeded to just devour all of the courses in philosophy that Carleton had to offer, and enjoyed it so much I even went back for a master's degree. Subsequent to that, I went to Boston University. I'm intending to be a Kant scholar. I went there to study with Henry Ellison, and quickly discovered that Kant scholarship wasn't where I wanted to end up, and so began to look around and eventually settled upon political philosophy and ended up working with Hugh Baxter and David Lyons, who are both appointed in the philosophy department and in the law school at Boston University. So the issues that sort of connect my interest in Kant scholarship and political philosophy center on the role of human judgment. I was interested in Kant's understanding of the capacity to judge, and in particular with his rather kind of quirky description and understanding of stupidity, the failure of the capacity to judge. And so when I decided to turn away from Kant scholarship and look at more contemporary political issues, that same focus on the problems of judgment and the potential for judgment to fail remained my focus. And so even though I ended up changing disciplines rather abruptly, or at least significantly, the background concerns that motivated me in this area have remained relatively constant. So even back then, I was worried about questions of judgment. But now my interests are focused more directly in democratic contexts and the ways in which theories of democracy can succeed or fail in addressing our concerns about the potential failures of human judgment and decision making.
Well, I'm going to ask you, once we get to talking about the book, about the idea of a behavioral approach to democratic theory. And note that the subtitle of the book is A Behavioral Approach to Democratic Theory. But let me just ask one, if you don't mind, just a question about your background. Because one of the things that comes through very early and strongly in the book is that you were exposed to a literature within economics and legal theory. Was this the result of your training with people who are cross-appointed in philosophy of law at Boston?
I think that's part of it. Also, while I was at Carleton University, one of the great things about the department was that we had a terminal MA program in philosophy, but we didn't have a PhD program. But there was a PhD program in cognitive science that was really exciting and had great students. And so as a result, I was kind of integrated and I took classes along with and, you know, just got into lots of great arguments with people who were being trained as cognitive scientists, but were taking a lot of philosophy classes and were interested in philosophical issues. And so even at that point, I think that I had begun to be exposed to sort of the empirical literature in a serious way. And so that began my engagement with some of the behavioral stuff. But you're right that once I got, once I made the transition to political philosophy, my advisor, Hugh Baxter in philosophy, is a Habermas scholar. And, you know, for someone like Hugh, the idea that you would take on this body of empirical research as part of your philosophical project, that just seemed completely natural to him. You know, he had to sort of learn all of this obscure German social theory just in order to get started in his field. And so,
right.
he was very supportive and just kind of encouraged me that this was the kind of thing that I could do. And didn't make it seem like a big deal. And it wasn't until after I had sort of waded through an enormous amount of this literature that I started to realize that this isn't something that everyone else does actually in philosophy, that I'm doing something kind of non-standard and for me really exciting. One of the things that I really enjoyed about my experiences writing the dissertation and then developing the book was the ability to engage with disciplines outside of philosophy and to learn a great deal about fields that are in many ways quite different from my own.
Well, let me say that this is one of the things about your book, Framing Democracy, that I think is very refreshing, in that it's a book that, I guess now to reveal some of my own preferences or prejudices, perhaps, where I usually don't like things that get characterized as interdisciplinary. But this is a book that is interdisciplinary, I think, in the good sense, in that you are actually an expert in different disciplines and not just an expert in one discipline trying to do work in another. Maybe this is a good way to begin sort of talking about the book, if that's okay. So one place to begin might be at the sort of the very general level. So you've already said that you're interested in bringing certain kinds of empirical results and interests and issues to bear on questions of normative democratic theory. And as I've already mentioned, that the subtitle of the book makes reference to a behavioral approach to democratic theory. Now, I take it that the idea of a behavioral approach or behavioral theory comes out of some fairly recent work in the disciplines of law and economics, and in fact comes out of the currently conjoint discipline that is known of as law and economics. And so without getting into the details of your own particular approach to behavioral issues, can you tell us a little bit about what a behavioral approach to any particular issue might look like, or what we mean by calling an approach behavioral?
Sure. I think the way that to understand it, the clearest way is just that the behavioral subdisciplines of economics, law and economics, finance, a bunch of these other sort of newer disciplines, sort of concerns or is interested in replacing the model of decision-making that has occupied the attention of people in the social sciences for a long time. And in particular, it's referred to as either the rational actor model or homo economicus or something like that. This idea that we understand human decision-making as a kind of rational utility maximization. And even more important than that, that it's highly sophisticated and very reliable rational utility maximizer. And so behavioral economics, behavioral law and economics, and these other disciplines have sought to increase the descriptive power of their disciplines by rejecting the rational actor model and seeking to replace it with a picture of decision-making imported from empirical psychology, from other social sciences. The idea being that if we actually want to understand how markets work, how the law works, how investing works, for example, we need to have a more sophisticated, less idealized picture of how humans make decisions, what kinds of phenomena affect their decision making, so on and so forth. And so the behavioral model is just one in which we seek to replace the rational actor model of human decision-making with something that is imported from empirical sciences and that provides us with increased descriptive power in the first instance. And I go on to claim that actually this is normatively important as well for disciplines like political philosophy and for democratic theory, because this is getting into my own view, but we can make substantive and important mistakes by relying on a descriptively inaccurate picture of how humans make decisions.
Well, let me ask a question again, just again about behavioral approaches in general, picking up on the last point that you've just made. Is it typical within this literature to see behavioral approaches as purely descriptive, and wanting to behavioral theorists want to resist the thought that there's a normative aspect, or at least normative results that one can draw out of behavioral data?
I don't think so. Most of the people who work, for example, in behavioral economics are interested in improving our decision-making. Similarly with people who work in behavioral approaches to law, I think that they are actually clearer about the normative importance of their projects than people who have worked, for example, in the sort of more traditional versions of their discipline. So I think that if anything, most people who work in behavioral social sciences are actually more keyed into and more attentive to the normative aspects of what they're doing than the disciplines that they came out of.
Right. Excellent. So let me, that's very helpful. Let me move now to another sort of aspect of the book, where I think it's also very nicely done, where you provide what might be thought of as sort of a map of the terrain, and it's a very complex terrain of contemporary democratic theory. As our listeners might know, democratic theory has been, you know, for the past 20 years or so at least, a really active part of political theory. It wasn't always the case. And so now the field is complex and rich and has got all kinds of things going on in it. So I found that one of the really welcome features of your book was the fact that you categorize different kinds of democratic theories or different democratic theories according to their epistemological elements or commitments. Now, I take it that part of your argument is that, and again, I think this is will be surprising to some readers, although I'm totally on board with this myself as somebody who thinks a little bit about democracy. I think that part of the argument is that any feasible view of democracy is going to involve some commitments regarding the epistemic abilities of democratic citizens, and that views that try to ignore that or downplay it or deny it are going to do so at the expense of their own feasibility or honesty. You know, that is that some views try to deny that there's any commitments about citizen competence, and then later in the view you find that it's smuggled in somehow covertly. But your view is that, and what you present in the book is a sort of charting of the field by looking at the strengths of these, or the varying strength of these epistemic presuppositions or commitments, or in some cases demands that are made. Can you walk us through this map of the territory and tell us about the different styles of democratic theory along this metric?
Sure. This sort of approach was born out of necessity that when I started to think about democracy in these terms and with an eye towards the research coming out of behavioral social sciences, I realized just how difficult it was to say anything intelligible about democratic theory. My own opinion is that it's actually misleading to talk about democratic theory as though it's a unified discipline. I think that if we're being careful, we'll recognize that it's just a very diverse conglomeration of individual theories of democracy. And so I needed to find some way of talking about these theories in a way that didn't just kind of paper over all of the important differences between them, but also that allowed me to make the set of claims that I wanted to. And so I had to come up with this kind of rather opinionated taxonomy of the field just to be able to get the project up and running. And so what I did is I sort of developed this spectrum of epistemic demandingness that is intended to sort of give us a way of sorting individual theories of democracy into something like a coherent narrative. And so what I do is I look at how much an individual theory of democracy demands of the reliability of individual citizens' political judgment. And I do think that there are some versions of democratic theory that rely little, if any, on the reliability of the political judgment of citizens. But I think to that extent, they reveal themselves to be rather unattractive and implausible. And so at the most minimal end, the end of the spectrum that demands the least of our judgment as citizens are purely procedural theories. These are theories that emphasize exclusively the procedural value of democratic decision making. And so the first and in some respects most powerful, or at least most the version of democratic theory that has had the widest impact outside of philosophy is social choice theory. Social choice theory sort of presents democracy as being a mechanism for having the preferences of citizens reflected in political or group decisions. And so this is a view that basically says that what matters about democracy is having preferences of individuals reflected somehow in the decisions of the group. And I point out that there's no constraints here on the kinds of preferences that individual citizens can have. They can be foolish, they can be self-destructive, they can be unjust, what have you. Preferences are kind of root on this account, and as a result, there's no real demands other than the fact that individuals have preferences and that they can serve to enter them into an aggregative function. I think, again, that this this is a theory of democracy, but I don't think it's terribly plausible when you recognize that there are no, if you view it sincerely in this way as a purely procedural theory, there are no constraints that we can place on the proper kinds of preferences that citizens have. And as a result, I really am suspicious about whether or not we can generate a convincing normative account on this basis. Slightly more appealing are what I call fair proceduralism. These are views that focus exclusively on the value of fairness and the claim that democratic procedures provide a fair way of resolving disagreements. Majoritarianism is sort of special in the fact that it gives us a way of treating everyone fairly. Again, I point out, relying quite heavily on David Esalen's arguments in this regard, that fairness conceived, if we're serious about it being purely fair proceduralism, it's a very thin and occasional value. This is Esalen's criticism.
Right.
And I think that this is true, that unless we build in some, you know, claims to bolster it, the fact that a procedure is fair doesn't tell us anything about whether or not it's going to lead to enormous errors, to self-destruct, or to founder in other ways. And so, again, I think that it's minimal in terms of its epistemic demands, but for that reason, rather unattractive. And there's a version of deliberative democracy, which I call the deliberative democracy, again, following Esalen. And the idea here is that this is a deliberative theory which completely rejects any external standards for the evaluation of democratic decisions, and said all we care is that the procedures engage citizens in deliberation, and that deliberation is good in its own right. It's not, we don't look to any external values. And so those are kind of the purely procedural theories, and I claim that even though they do represent very minimal demands upon the judgment of citizens, they are for that reason morally relatively unappealing.
Right, and just to stop, it also seems that for at least some of these purely procedural views, more obviously than others, but I think for all of them, that whatever the theorist offering the view specifies as the procedural value, there's often a obviously non-democratic alternative procedure that realizes that value. So the famous, now I take it, Esalen example for fair proceduralism is, you know, we could always just flip coins. That would be really, really fair in a way, but democratically totally unavailable or undesirable.
And I think that this is revealing, because one of the things that we intuitively see immediately with the coin toss example is that a coin toss could result in enormously self-destructive or unjust results, and that's a problem. And so I think that Many people who claim to be fair proceduralists in particular are actually covertly smuggling in substantive claims about the reliability of democratic decision making. And so the reason why we react so obviously against the idea that we should just make decisions by flipping coins is because, well, that seems like we could have such terrible decisions being made, even though they would be fair decisions. And so I take this as evidence that that many of the people who purport to be giving us a purely procedural theory of democracy are actually covertly committed to more substantial claims about democratic results and the need to subject them to standards of evaluation that are not procedural. And so, but, you know, in the first instance, what I try and do in the book is I try and give these theories a kind of platform to stand on their own 2 feet, and I don't subject them to this kind of criticism. But I think at the end of the day, when we're thinking about these theories in the final analysis, we have to recognize that in order for pure proceduralisms to be plausible, they need to incorporate some demands on people's decision making. For example, I think that the fact that we could, in a democracy, make decisions which put an end to democracy. We could make decisions that disenfranchise a large number of people. We could make decisions that advocate control to some sovereign. What many people do is they claim to be giving us a purely procedural theory, but in fact they're making the claim that citizens aren't going to make those mistakes, that we can rely on citizens not to disenfranchise one another, not to abdicate control. But if they do that, then they end up ranking much further down my spectrum of epistemic demandingness.
Right.
So to give you the sort of description,
sure.
The next set of views are stability theories. These are views that will be recognizable coming out of people like Joseph Schumpeter and Richard Posner, that claim that the central value of democracy is its capacity to ensure stability and to avoid the violence and bloodshed that has characterized the transition of power between non-democratic governments. And so in their austere form, these theories simply point out that democracies seem to be more stable than other forms of government, and that's what recommends them. In their augmented form, they add considerations about competition, the selection of political elites that have good judgment, and the protection of political freedoms to sort of give more body, more substance to their endorsement of democracy. But in their most austere form, I think, the way to understand stability theories is just claiming that democracy is a good way of preventing blood from running in the streets when we have political conflict, and that the central value that we ought to ascribe to democratic rule. And again, I think that this requires us to make some minimal demands upon the judgment of citizens. They, you know, citizens need to respect the outcomes of elections, and they need to recognize that it is in their interest to respect the outcome of elections.
Mm-hmm.
And on the augmented stability theories, where they add claims about competition, selection, and political freedom, there is increasing demands placed upon the judgment of citizens. For example, the ability to select from a pool of candidates those that are actually that does possess sound political judgment, or that would make good leaders, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Again, here we're moving up the spectrum of epistemic demands, and but we're still at a point where I think the kinds of values that we can expect from a theory of democracy to be rather limited. So although I don't disagree that stability is a good thing, it seems like a rather minimal basis upon which to recommend democracy as an institution. So from there, I continue sort of moving up the trajectory towards the most epistemically demanding theories of democracy. And so the next category are modified procedural theories. These are theories that incorporate claims, but the value of political procedures. For example, I start with a description of unorthodox sexual choice theory, which is kind of my attempt to reconstruct to over the last couple of maybe 10 or 15 years with his theory of expressive voting and his considerations about the proper reform of electoral institutions. And what I find out is that he seems to be making substantive claims about the kinds of decisions that people make in a democracy coming out of his theory of expressive voting. And so this is these are kind of hybrid that they recognize the procedural value of democracy, but they also add claims about the ability of democracy to generate substantively good decisions where we subject those decisions to an analysis against standards of evaluation regarding things like truth or correctness or justice or what have you. Similarly, I present a version of epistemic deliberative democracy, which conjoins traditional deliberative claims about the value of deliberation and the kinds of norms that are required for proper deliberation to an attempt to generate substantively good and correct decisions. And finally, in this section, I discuss David Esalen's epistemic proceduralism, which I think is usefully compared to epistemic deliberative democracy in that what I take Esalen to be doing is he's generating a theory of democratic authority and democratic legitimacy, which requires that human decision-making be adequate or a certain standard in order for us to be able to expect both that democracy be a legitimate form of government and also for it to be capable of making decisions that are of a high enough quality that we ought to endorse democracy over other forms of decision making that he claims would pass general acceptability. So again, what we see here is theories of democracy that conjoin epistemic claims about good decision making to procedural claims. The most demanding set of theories, in my estimation, are what I call epistemic theories, and I actually begin with a description of your theory of democracies. Take it a little bit
right.
Of this javelin thinking about democracy. and so I begin with dialogical democracy, which you know, you can probably summarize it better than I can, but I'll give it a go, is the view that we ought to reject attempts to justify democratic rule via moral norms and instead look to epistemic reasons for endorsing democracy. And in particular, I argue that your view endorses democracy specifically because it is the system of social structure or social norms that gives us the best shot at a kind of epistemic agency. And so on this account, we are committed to democracy by our folk epistemology. How does that?
That's right. That's the view.
Makes me feel better. And so this is a very epistemically demanding theory. It requires a lot. The title you give to it in Democracy and Moral Conflict is kind of it requires an epistemically perfectionist state. And so that gives you an idea of what kinds of epistemic demands we're placing upon the judgment of citizens.
Right.
The only sort of popular theories that I think outstrip your own in terms of epistemic demandingness are Condorcetian theories that ground the justification of democracy in Condorcet's jury theorem. And these are demanding because they both require that everyone has, on average, above average competence in terms of their likelihood of getting the correct answer to a given question or problem, and also that imposes strictures on the kind of political communication that can occur in a democratic society to ensure that people are actually independent of one another in terms of how they make decisions. The most demanding, and I think in this respect quite implausible, theory of democracy simply claims that democratic decisions are legitimate if and only if they are correct. And so the entire substance of the democratic theory is focused upon the claim that democracies can and do make correct decisions about important political questions. And on this view, democracies sort of abdicate or cease to have any legitimacy whatsoever when they fail to adhere to independent standards of correctness.
Well, excellent. That's very helpful, and I rather like this general way of slicing up the field. Let me move on now, because the heart of the book is, and it's reflected in the title, Framing Democracy. The heart of the book is your effort to try to bring to bear on this range of theories a series of results, a particular series of results, one should say, from the behavioral approach. And these results are called framing effects. Can you tell us a little bit about framing effects and give us some insight into or a sense of your own analysis of them? What are framing effects?
I'll give you a little bit of background to start. When I first started the project, I had in mind that I would just give a full-blooded behavioral approach where I address a huge number or a large number of different biases or different kinds of problems with human decision-making. And it became clear fairly quickly that that was much too ambitious a project, that in order for me to be able to say anything really satisfactory about the empirical issues and in order to give the kind of case that I think philosophers would think is plausible or convincing, and then also to do justice to the empirical results so that people working on the empirical side would actually sort of take these seriously, I needed to spend a lot more time working on one particular set of issues. And so the heuristics and biases of literature, which is a literature that came out of the research of Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, who subsequently won the Economics Nobel for their work, gives a whole range of different kinds of biases. The basic claim is that we can understand human decision-making best if we think of it as being governed by a small or manageable set of simple rules to decision problems, and they call these heuristics. And then they go on to claim that these heuristics, while generally quite reliable and successful at solving decision problems, result in a kind of systematic bias towards certain kinds of mistakes in specifiable contexts. And so that's the original literature that I was interested in. I decided that it was too broad. So within that literature, I started looking around for something that was quite pervasive, that was empirically well confirmed, and that seemed to be, from the perspective of the behavioral sciences, kind of uncontroversial. People who work in the empirical side just take framing effects, the phenomenon that I decided to focus upon, as just kind of part of the landscape of human decision making. There are debates about how to understand its specifics and whatnot, but it's just considered to be part of the furniture of the world for people working in the empirical study of human decision making. And so a framing effect occurs when different decision frames or different ways of presenting a decision affect the decisions that people make. And so it's, you know, this is quite sort of, I don't know, it scores with my experience quite clearly that depending on how a decision is presented to me, even if I recognize at the end of the day that the different presentations of the decision are equivalent, I recognize that my own decisions can be impacted or can be swayed by the way they are framed. And so this is a general characterization of framing effects. A more kind of specific one is the one that has sort of dominated our thinking about economics and related fields, equivalency framing. When formally equivalent presentations of a decision problem elicit different choices. And so in this context, we recognize that we can generate formal proofs that show, for example, that two different outcomes are equivalent, even if they may appear initially to be different. So I think the most famous and the, in some ways, most scary version of this has to do with the framing of outcome statistics for different kinds of medical treatments. Depending upon whether a physician frames an outcome for you in terms of mortality or in terms of survival, they can put a subtle pressure on you to choose one or other of the options. And so the example is, imagine that you're diagnosed with cancer and that you have to choose between surgery and radiation. And the physician tells you that surgery has a 90% survival rate after some specified period of time, and that radiation has a 10% mortality rate. The empirical research sort of supports that, heavily supports the view that the frames that are made in terms of survival tend to be more effective. People will choose the option that's framed in terms of survival more than they will choose the frame that is in terms of mortality, even if they are formally equivalent. You know, 90% survival is equivalent to 10% mortality. And so this is how a lot of research on framing effects is conducted. It's conducted in these areas where we can show formal equivalence between the different frames. But the effect of framing extends beyond areas in which we can generate these formal proofs to questions that are of more obvious political salience. And so what I do in the book is I walk us quickly through the history of how these kinds of effects have been studied, even before Kahneman and Tversky. I'm looking at some examples from question ordering effects. So the fact that the way that a series of questions is presented to you, the order of questions can impact upon your decision-making. And question ordering effects, there's this great set of data from the U.S. General Social Survey that shows that Americans' positions on policy issues change significantly when you change the wording of specific questions, even though the substance of them seems to be exactly the same. And political context effects, the fact that the background conditions in which people evaluate issues can influence our decision making. And so the example that I think is most striking to me in this area, especially when we're talking about what I call emphasis framing effects. So emphasis framing effects are framing effects that, how do I put it in the book? I'm going to read it. An emphasis framing effect occurs when emphasizing different elements of a decision problem elicits different choices. And so I think the most troubling example for me concerns a bunch of research about affirmative action and the fact that people's level of support for affirmative action varies quite significantly depending upon how it is framed. So the different frames for affirmative action programs can be ending racial discrimination. It can be specifically about the set of policy instruments covered by affirmative action. They can be, it can be framed in terms of banning preferential treatment and so on and so forth. And depending on which one of those frames are used, the amount of support that Americans in particular will give to these kinds of programs varies considerably. And so this is an example of an emphasis framing effect, which I think is directly relevant to our thinking about democracy, that the fact that people's preferences and judgments about affirmative action are susceptible to the framing of the choice really throws into question how we understand the value and the resilience of democratic decision making.
Right. So now the argument of the book, and this is the central argument, is that none of the going theories of democracy, regardless of how epistemic they are overtly or in the covert cases, whatever kind of epistemology gets smuggled in, that none of them pays sufficient attention to these effects. And that's a problem with the theories. That is that once you say that epistemology has to figure into your account of democracy or democratic authority or whatever else you think you're doing when you're theorizing about democracy, once epistemology plays a role in that, then the empirical results concerning actual human reasoning and decision making have to figure in as well. So I take it that this is all bad news for the more demanding epistemologically theories, and maybe it's bad news for any theory. Is that right?
It's troubling news. It need not be bad news depending upon how demanding the theory is. So if you have a theory that's at the more or the less demanding end of the spectrum, then these results, I think, will be less troubling. But certainly those theories that present or expect substantively good decisions being made by the citizens in a democracy, yeah, this is very good. And what the thing that sort of motivated the project was that this very bad news has been around for a really long time. So the literature that I was just describing to you is just one kind of part of a set of empirical results that has been calling into question people's decision-making in a democracy. Philip Converse is sort of the other body of literature that people often worry about, which is his research concerns the kinds of information that people have available to them in a democracy and whether or not that information is in any way reliable. And so, yeah, I think there are a lot of reasons why we should be very concerned about the ability of actual citizens and voters to measure up to the kinds of demands that philosophical theories of democracy place on them for the proper function of a democratic society. And so it is the case, though, that if you have an exceedingly minimal theory of democracy, like a social choice theory or perhaps even an austere stability theory, that perhaps the kinds of demands that we place upon the judgment of citizens, maybe they can survive the concerns about framing effects. But I think that for more demanding and more substantive theories of democracy, then we ought to be really concerned about the integrity of people's decision making. And what I go on to claim in later in the book is that we need to realize that the design of institutions of democracy need to be forefront in our thinking about these questions, because insofar as we have any ability to improve or to counteract the problems stemming from framing effects, it's going to be through the proper design of institutions in democracy.
Right. So, and I want to make sure we have time to talk about some of your positive policy proposals for dealing with or in some way mitigating or at least recognizing the framing effects in our democratic theory. But first, you do address or talk about some of the ways in which proponents of these variously epistemically committed democratic theories attempt or might attempt to downplay or to sidestep these issues. So some views employ various kinds of idealizations, for example. Other views set the bar so low that everybody's going to meet some kind of basic level of epistemic competence. Can you talk a little bit about these ways of trying to evade the full impact, or at least as you see it, the full impact of these results?
I think that the most common way that people integrate claims about epistemic competence into their democratic theories that they just assert that we have capacities that meet the demands of the theory. And so, you know, the way that I sort of frame this is I think that we should think about epistemic competence as a threshold concept, and that we say that someone is competent if they surpass some threshold, but that threshold has to be specified by the theory of democracy. And what I think most people have done in the history of democratic theory is just to sort of assert that voters are good enough, that they have capacities that surpass what is required. The problem with this kind of approach is that it leaves us open to empirical disagreements. And so if it's the case, and I think it is the case, that the empirical literature on human decision-making is troubling, that it paints a picture of human decision-making that that is significantly less reliable than most of us might have expected it to be, then we have to then defend our theory of democracy on empirical grounds using evidence and data in a way that is really unfamiliar to people working in philosophical theories of democracy, and I think really unattractive. And so this idea that we can just factually assert it, I think, is a bad strategy. I don't think that that's actually what people working in what philosophy ought to do, and that I think democratic theories are ill-served by this kind of approach. A more attractive way of approaching epistemic competence, I think, is just by is just employing a kind of approach from ideal theory, and just to say, listen, when we're thinking about justice, when we're thinking about legitimacy, when we're thinking about authority, we often will make idealizing assumptions about, you know, scarcity of resources, whether or not people are prone to envy, what have you. There's, you know, political philosophy does this all the time. And we just sort of, you know, idealize the problem away. We just assume that people are competent in order for us to be able to direct our attention to questions about what would ideally be the case, what would an ideal democracy look like, what would democratic authority or legitimacy look like if everyone had all of the capacities required. And again, I don't have a problem with this as an approach to democratic theory. I'm broadly sympathetic with people like David Esland, who sort of present this as an attempt to generate a theory of democracy that's doing something comparable to Rawls's attempt to generate an ideal theory of justice. I just simply don't think that that's enough. I think that even if ideal theories of democracy are interesting in their own right, I don't see why that means that that should be the entirety of philosophical discussions of democracy. And I guess in general, I am kind of sympathetic with critics like C.W. Mills and others that sort of think that we need in philosophy to direct more of our attention to the analysis of conditions and situations that actually resemble the conditions and situations that we live under. And so my view is that even if it's a permissible philosophical move to idealize competence away, that doesn't mean that that's all we should be doing in philosophy. And I think that we have in philosophy we've got enough ideal theorizing going on, and I would like to see more of our attention directed towards non-ideal circumstances and cases. And so I don't reject the possibility or the appropriate of this kind of a move. I just don't see why it should occupy all attention in philosophical discussions. The last version,
please.
Did you want to jump in?
No, please go on.
A version or approach is the moral principle. And this is, again, quite common. The idea is that we ought to treat individuals as though they were competent on moral grounds, that we try and generate a moral argument for why treating individuals as competent is morally appropriate or morally required. And I think that this is attractive, and I would like for this to be the case, but I can't see why, I can't come up with an explanation for why this is permissible that doesn't seem ad hoc or to sort of fly in the face of the concerns that we have. My concern is that if we treat individuals as competent on a given theory of democracy, and we don't actually meet the epistemic demands of that theory, I'm concerned that there could be really bad consequences that result. And so I don't see, although it's possible that someone could come up with a moral argument that would make these problems go away, I haven't seen one. And so I think that we ought to really question whether or not we can expect the goods that democracy is held to offer to accrue to us if we don't actually have the capacities required by the theory.
Right. So picking up on this then, especially the concerns to make a move within the realm that's often referred to as non-ideal theory, where you're actually trying to take the cruel facts of the world and to point a way forward and things that we could actually do now to try to improve our situation with respect to justice or freedom or something. Can you talk – I mean the book ends with very suggestive discussions of some actual policy interventions that you would recommend in light of the framing effects and their bearing on democratic theory. Can you walk us through a little bit of that
sure,
part of the book?
Sure. So I divide up the landscape into sort of three broad ways that institutions can attempt to respond or address framing effects. And so the first is through institutions governing political speech. The second is through insulating strategies. And the third is through education. And maybe what I'll do is I'll take them up in reverse order here, just because I think the education example or the option is often the most attractive to people. What we can do is we can try and use an educational system to reduce or eliminate our susceptibility to framing effects. This is really attractive because we already have institutions of education, at least some institutions of public education, and we could use those institutions to try and sort of eliminate the problem at its source by just removing our susceptibility to framing. This is really attractive, but there's very little empirical evidence to support the view that it's feasible. So unfortunately, most of the attempts that have been made to use, you know, education in various forms to reduce our susceptibility to framing haven't had terribly much success. It seems like it's possible to reduce our susceptibility to framing effects in specific areas of our lives. So, you know, if you are trained to watch out for framing effects in the giving and receiving of medical advice, that you can sometimes reduce one's susceptibility to framing, but it doesn't seem like it's generalizable, that there's anything that we have been able to do which across the board makes us less likely to be influenced by frames. And so although I agree that it would be great if we could use an educational system to address these concerns in a democracy, I just don't see there being terribly much hope in this area. The literature here, the most interesting stuff is by someone named Baruch Fischoff, and he's tried things like developing undergraduate or a sort of high school curricula using sort of critical thinking modules and developing to address framing effects and other kinds of biases. And none of them seem to be as effective as we would hope. So I don't think that education is going to be the solution, at least not given the kinds of attempts that have been made so far. And so two other options sort of present themselves. The first are insulating strategies. These are mechanisms that attempt to prevent bad decisions being made by the electorate, let's say, from actually impacting upon people's lives. And so this is a way of trying to insulate democratic outcomes from flawed decision-making. So preventing our susceptibility from to framing effects from actually resulting, for example, in bad law. And so what I do here in this section is I just recast and whole sort of existing literature and democratic theory concerning constitutions and judicial review and other kinds of review. I just recast all of those debates in terms of our desire to bolster the democratic value of democratic decisions. And so I think that we can understand constitutions as a way of insulating decisions from really bad mistakes. And the way that we do this is we sort of say, well, here's this constitution. It prevents us from making certain really kinds of bad decisions regarding rights in particular. And so even if the electorate makes mistakes, we have a mechanism that insulates outcomes from those bad decisions. And so this leads to a description of review mechanisms, in particular of the Supreme Court and its role here, where I attempt to generate an argument which says, listen, we can expect the members of a Supreme Court, if we design the institutions properly, to be less susceptible to framing effects than the average citizen. And if that's the case, then we can expect judicial review to actually bolster and improve and insulate democratic decisions from flawed decision-making. Again, this is, I'm trying not to reinvent the wheel in these sections, but what I'm doing is I'm looking at, in particular, Jeremy Waldron's court case against judicial review and attempting to explain how we can make sense of those arguments within the framework that I provided in the rest of the book. And so the last remaining institution that I think is useful for addressing and counteracting framing effects has to do with political speech, and in particular with the promotion of competition between frames in a democracy. The idea being that, and this is supported to some degree by the empirical literature, that greater competition between frames, having a plurality of frames for a given political issue, reduces our susceptibility to any given frame, and that the hope is that if we are presented with enough and a varied range of frames for a political question, then we will be less swayed by the content of the frames and more attentive to the substantive issues in question. And so I sort of look at this analogy with antitrust institutions, democracies, and look to the possibility of using existing democratic institutions to bolster or to improve the amount of competition between frames, for example, by strengthening the multi-party nature of elections. I think that two-party systems are not going to be sufficient to improve the caliber of democratic decision-making. And I think that ways to diversify the number of political parties are necessary. But I also look at the problem of media consolidation and the possibility that that a restriction in the number of media frames for political decisions will serve to reduce or weaken or make less reliable the decision of democratic electorates. And so I look, in this section, I sort of use Habermas and his recent work on media ethics in order to sort of try and propose some strategies for how we might go about ensuring that there's a effective, vigorous amount of debate between or competition between frames in the media, and in the hope that that would be sufficient to improve our decision making and make it less susceptible to framing effects.
So all's not lost.
No, I think that there is hope. But what I hope that people take away from the book is that if we are committed to these more ambitious and more morally substantive theories of democracies, theories of democracy, then we have to recognize that there are substantive institutional questions that need to be addressed, and that we cannot be complacent about the epistemic capacities and epistemic competencies of citizens. And so I fear that what happens is that people endorse these more robust and more demanding theories of democracy, and they don't realize the institutional implications of these views. And so they don't realize how much this impacts or ought to impact upon our thinking about the design of institutions in a democracy. And so the point of the book is very much to sort of say, listen, if you are on board with my empirical claims about our susceptibility to framing effects, and it seems like you have two options. One is you can reduce your expectations from democracy by reducing or kind of giving up on a set of moral claims about what democracy has to offer. And so we can just sort of, you know, revert to the minimalist end of the spectrum and say, well, we can't expect very much from democracy. That's an option. I don't think it's terribly attractive because I don't really see what we can substantively expect from democracy once we go that route. And so if we don't go that route and we actually say, okay, we're going to insist upon these more ambitious claims about democratic decision making, then we need to double down and we need to recognize that there are institutional strings attached, that there are we have made substantive commitments to the epistemic abilities of citizens, and we ought to be willing to make sacrifices and to dedicate resources in order to ensure that people have the epistemic capacities that we require of them.
Excellent. Well, you've been very generous with your time, and we're winding down with our interview. So I ask usually at the end of these, but some have claimed is an unfair question, especially when posed to somebody who's just finished a book. And folks, this book has just come out. But Jamie, can you tell us what the next project has, what the next project is, or where you plan to go next in your thinking?
Yeah. So
long pause.
There's a couple of things that I'm continuing to do. So one is I still have my eye on sort of the broader behavioral approach, and I continue to read actively in the empirical side of things to sort of keep myself abreast of the developments. So I'm still interested in the behavioral approach of democratic theory more generally and sort of thinking about that. But I've also gotten interested recently in questions about immigration as they pertain to democratic theory, and starting to worry about the possibility that institutions of democracy, as I present them and the kinds of institutions that I think are useful for improving the epistemic capacities and epistemic reliability of democracies, might be in conflict with the demands of collective self-determination that people have been focusing upon recently in debates regarding, for example, the right to exclude and other areas in which thinking about democracies as kinds of group agents has been increasingly important for people's thinking. And so I'm working on a project right now that seeks to put collective self-determination into conflict with the kinds of institutions that I think are needed in order to ensure that we are making good decisions in a democracy.
Well, excellent. That sounds exciting. If this new work results in a book, maybe we'll have you back on New Books in Philosophy. But for now, I just wanted to thank you for your time and for talking to us about your book, Framing Democracy, A Behavioral Approach to Democratic Theory.
Thanks, Bob. This has been great.
Take care now. You have been listening to my interview with Professor Jamie Kelly of Vassar College. We have been talking about his new book, Framing Democracy, published by Princeton University Press. I'm Robert Talish, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.